her tone milder than before. This was a question to which she had an answer. I was just at Starlight. It's finished, but for perhaps a bit of polishing and clean-up, she said. A short delay shouldn't have much impact on the schedule. She gestured at Eivor. Master Chris was there recently as well, just before the Legacy Run disaster for the inspection tour, reviewing the Jedi Quarter. How did it seem to you?
As you say, Master Molly, she answered. I'm not an expert, but Administrator Tenem explicitly said Starlight Beacon could hold its dedication ceremony as scheduled. If not for the blockade, the last little touches would be complete in a few weeks from now. She does not seem the type to exaggerate.
All right, then, Lena said. Let's figure this out. I have questions.
She lifted her hand and started to tick them off on her fingers one by one.
How many fragments remain of the Legacy Run? Do any of them contain survivors? And if so, is there a chance those people could be rescued? They're all Republic citizens, and if we can save them, we must. Is there a way to predict where any remaining emergencies might happen? And most important,
she closed her hand into a fist.
What actually happened? And why? Is hyperspace safe? Or is this all just getting started?
No one responded. They all knew better than to speculate.
I'm asking all of you to find out. You represent administrators, politicians, the security forces, and of course, the Jedi. Some of you were present at the Legacy Run disaster. Between you, there should be more than enough skill and connections to determine what happened and prevent it from happening again. The resources of the Republic and all the authority of my office are available to you. Create any teams you like. Draft anyone you think might be useful. The Starlight Beacon is due to open in 30 days. I would like to use the occasion to celebrate a Republic triumph over adversity. I do not wish to open that station while a huge swath of the galaxy is locked down, underscoring the Republic's inability to keep its citizens safe. Use the Starlight Beacon dedication as your deadline. Figure this out, my friends. I believe you can.
Chancellor Lena So reached out to either side, burying her hands in the fur of Matari and Voru, taking comfort in their warmth and presence. She looked up above the tree line, to the very peak of Umate, just 20 meters above. Once, the mountain must have dominated this part of the planet, the queen of the entire Minari range. Now, it was just a small chunk of stone poking up from the surface of a world that had utterly swallowed it up, dwarfed by everything around it. Umate remained, though, the benefit of a choice made generation after generation to preserve the mountain, even in this attenuated form. Lena So appreciated that, the way societies could choose heritage over progress, represented here in living stone. But to the Chancellor, Umate had a second meaning, a symbolism she would never voice, never speak aloud, as it went against the general spirit of optimism and hope and possibility that was a cornerstone of her government and, indeed, the Republic itself. That meaning was this. There was nothing so big it could not be swallowed up. Nothing so strong it could not be humbled. Nothing so tall it could not be made small. Not a mountain, and not the Republic.
I am not prone to dire pronouncements, the Chancellor said, still looking at Umate's peak. But if this continues to get worse, and we somehow lose the ability to travel through hyperspace, all of this ends. There will be no more Republic.
Her gaze shifted from the mountain to the night sky beyond, Coruscant was a city world, radiating light at all hours, making it impossible to see many stars even in the depths of night. Just a few points of light were visible, shining faintly, separated by great swaths of emptiness.
Just worlds, alone in the dark.
Chapter 20, Hetzal System, the Third Horizon.
The assembly droid moved the bit of wreckage into place, its manipulator arms making minute adjustments to the small metal fragment. How the droid knew where to place the piece in the overall puzzle being assembled, or the original purpose of any given chunk of wreckage, that was a task for an advanced computational motivator circuit, and beyond what Elzar Mann could easily understand. To him, one ragged piece of Durasteel looked very much like the next. The process seemed to be working, though. Inside a large rectangular area of space, illuminated by huge floodlights, the outline of the ship that was once the Legacy Run was clearly visible. About a dozen of the assembly droids were working to pull pieces of wreckage from the open bay doors of a huge cargo freighter parked just outside the range of the lights. One by one, the droids pushed bits of metal and plastoid into place in the reconstruction zone, some as large as full compartments, and some as small as a single wire. It was as if they were trying to rebuild the starship out of pieces of junk they had found here and there. That was more or less the task, actually. Wreckage from the initial disaster in Hetzal had been collected after it dropped out of hyperspace, tracked by a huge network of satellites and monitoring stations and telescopes. The system had been bashed together during the disaster by an apparently brilliant local named Kaven Tar, a pale, quiet young man who was at this very moment standing a meter or so to Elzar's left. He wasn't alone, either. A whole group had gathered to bear witness to the destroyed starship, staring silently at the wreckage through a viewing panel on the Third Horizon's observation deck. Not much was left. The assembly droids were doing their best, but many pieces of the Legacy Run were destroyed on their impact with objects in the Hetzal system, or it simply whipped through the system and vanished before they could be collected. Some had appeared in other systems via the emergences, of which there had been 18 to date. Those pieces had been brought here as well, when possible. But still more might be in hyperspace, waiting to emerge in their own right and wreak devastation in some other part of the Outer Rim. That was the point of trying to pull the wreckage together, to estimate how much still remained to be found, to see how bad it could really get. Elzar noticed that one of the smaller pieces of wreckage was drifting out of true, possibly disturbed by one of the assembly droids jetting away, or just moved by a gust of stellar wind. He lifted his hand and made a subtle gesture. The piece moved back into place, as if guided by an invisible touch. He felt eyes on him and glanced to his right, where Jedi Master Avar Kriss was looking at him. Of course she had sensed him using the Force. That was Avar's gift, one among many. She called it the Song, and she heard it always. Elzar winked at her. Avar rolled her eyes, but the side of her mouth lifted up in a little smile. She couldn't help it. He knew Avar thought he used the Force for frivolous purposes from time to time, but he couldn't understand the viewpoint. If you could use the Force, then you should use the Force. What? You were supposed to save it for special occasions? It wasn't as if the Force would run out. Avar heard a song, and Elzar saw a sea of endless depth and breadth. The Force never began or ended, and it was impossible to use it up. So if Jedi Knight Elzar Mann could help out a struggling assembly droid with a little push from the Force, why not? What was the harm? He knew Avar agreed, even if she'd never admit it. The little smile told him everything he needed to know.
How much of the legacy run do we have here?
Asked Jeffo Lorillia, the Republic's Secretary of Transportation. The poor man seemed tense. A muscle in his endlessly long forehead seemed to have developed an involuntary twitch. That was understandable. The man's entire job was to ensure safe, reliable travel throughout the Republic. And yet, the Chancellor had just extended her hyperspace blockade for the Outer Rim another 50 parsecs after the 18th emergence near Dantooine. Kaventar consulted a datapad he was holding.
I've got schematics here for the ship's superstructure, he said, and the manifest from the shipping company that lists everything it was carrying. I'd say we've got about a third. Your brain takes the outline we've built here and fills it in. Tells you you're seeing a full ship, but we really don't have that much.
Elzar thought it looked like the ghost of a ship, but decided not to make that observation in a system where so many people had died. Abdalis had gotten it worse, of course. 20 million dead on its primary world was an unspeakable tragedy, but Hetzal had suffered plenty of damage. And more to come across the rim, it sounded like.
So this won't be over for ages, Senator Noir all but moaned.
The Outer Rim representative understood the consequences of hyperspace closures just as much as Secretary Lorillia. These worlds were already considered by some to be backwaters, and if you couldn't even travel to them, well, the galaxy contained many worlds. Easy to forget a whole sector if need be.
We don't know that, Senator, Eivor said. The investigation has barely begun.
Senator Noir shot a glare at Eivor.
And meanwhile, Madam Jedi, he spat, the poor beleaguered people of the Outer Rim, who depend on the shipping lanes for their very existence, creep closer to chaos with every moment. I'm already hearing reports of hoarding on a number of worlds, and the economic impact mounts with every passing day.
Noir pointed out the viewport at the remains of the Legacy Run, spotlit and floating in space.
Why are we even here? It's a wrecked cargo ship. What does it matter? You need to get out there, find out what happened, find out who did this.
You believe the disaster was deliberate, Senator?
Elzar asked.
An attack?
Noir threw up his hands.
What other conclusion should I draw? Hetzal is the agricultural heart of the Outer Rim. Perhaps some planet farther coreward became jealous of the credits flowing here and wanted to wreck our food supply. Maybe it was Selkath, angry about the prospect of Bacta putting them out of business. All I know is neither the Republic nor the Jedi are doing anything to find the culprit. You're just staring out into space. What are you even doing here? You're not part of the Chancellor's committee.
I assure you, Senator, this man is never just staring at anything, Eivor said. Let me introduce you to Elzar Mann, a Jedi Knight of my long acquaintance. He was present here in the system during the disaster. He was instrumental in helping the Jedi prevent the Tabana fragment from impacting the sun. Without his strength, Hetzal would no longer exist.
We all did our part,
Elzar murmured. Somewhere inside, though, he was pleased Eivor had noticed. Dozens of Jedi working together in that final moment. No, thousands, really, if what Eivor had told him was accurate. And despite all that, she knew what he specifically had done.
Of course, Senator Noir said. We appreciate your efforts, but my point remains. We're running out of time. After all, the Chancellor's precious starlight beacon languishes out in space, waiting to be brought online. What if an emergence hits that, eh? I bet then you people would finally get moving.
Elzar Mann reached out and placed his hand over the senator's mouth. Above his fingers, he could see the man's eyes go wide with shock.
Shh, Elzar said.
We're moving, I promise. Just not in ways you can see. The Force doesn't feel the need to announce its actions. It just acts. He removed his hand. The Senator was stunned into silence, which was the idea all along. In fact, everyone present seemed pretty surprised as well. Sometimes, Elzar believed, it was important to remind people that no matter how important they thought they were in fact just people. He could probably have accomplished the same goal via the mind trick. Noar's mind seemed weak, like most politicians, but Eivor absolutely would not approve, and Elzar knew it. Normally, that wouldn't matter so much. Eivor Kriss was an old, close friend, which meant they could disagree, even squabble like nesting scree rats and come out the other side just fine. But now, here, things were different. The Council had put Eivor in charge of the Jedi's response to the emergencies due to her actions during the Legacy Run disaster. It was a huge assignment. And who had she chosen as her partner for the investigation? Oh, none other than Jedi Knight Elzar Mann. Now, why had she done that? Elzar thought he knew. He and Eivor had a history, sure, and worked well together. And he was good with many Force techniques, including some pretty obscure ones. But he didn't believe any of those were the reason. Plenty of other Jedi were just as qualified as he was. Elzar figured Eivor picked him because doing well on this mission could help him attain the one real achievement he cared about within the Jedi, making Master. When you were a Master, you could pursue your own studies, move forward through the Force on your own terms. In fact, the Council expected Masters to do exactly that. It sounded like paradise, but a paradise that had thus far remained elusive. Doing well with the Legacy Run investigation, showing the Council that he could help the Order with its goals just as much as his own, it could make a huge difference. In other words, Eivor Kriss had chosen him as her partner because she was trying to help him, and Elzar didn't want to give her any reason to regret the choice. So, no mind trick. Well, not unless there was no other way.
I'm good at anticipating problems, Senator, said Eivor. My colleague here, Elzar Mann, is good at solutions. He tends to find a unique way through most issues, paths others can't see. I promise we'll figure this out. As you said, we're running out of time.
She turned to look out once again at what remained of the Legacy Run.
I see two problems here to be solved. They encompass everything else. First, the emergencies. We need to ensure nothing like what happened at Hetzal and Abdalis happens again. Second, we need to figure out whatever is causing the emergencies, which may be what also caused the original disaster. I believe this wreckage could help us with that. But that's just a hunch. I'm not a forensic scientist. Still, I know amazing things can be learned from even tiny bits of material, if the right kind of analysis is applied. Are we doing that?
Yes, I have technicians from my department going over the data, and we learn more with every new piece we find,
Secretary Lorelia replied.
So far, nothing conclusive, but there may be an easy way to get a much clearer picture.
He gestured to a vid screen in the chamber, displaying a detailed schematic of the Legacy Run in its original pre-destruction form.
This class of cargo carrier has a dedicated flight recorder system, extremely durable, specifically hardened to survive catastrophic disasters. It could tell us more about what transpired in the final moments before the Legacy Run disintegrated.
I thought of that too, Secretary. But the assembly droids haven't found it yet, said Kaven Tar, reviewing his notes. It could already have emerged somewhere else, or it might still be in hyperspace.
Impossible to tell. We'll just have to wait and hope it gets found.
Well, Kaven said, I had an idea about that. The surveillance network I engineered during the disaster was designed to monitor the entire solar system in real time and track the debris as closely as possible. Pick up new fragments as they emerged from hyperspace and follow their paths. This is what it looked like while it was happening.
He held up his datapad, triggering its projection function to display a larger image of the system. Long, thin lines wove through Hetzal, all headed on gently curving arcs toward the three suns at its center.
There's a lot of data here, Kaven said. And when I link it with the other 18 emergences...
He tapped his datapad a few times, and the image changed, now expanding out to encompass a good section of the outer rim. More thin lines appeared here and there, 18 sets beyond the original deadly bloom in Hetzal.
It sort of makes a picture. I don't really have it yet. I don't have the processing power, but if I could get enough droids... probably Navidroids, because they're good at calculating hyperspace routes, I might be able to figure out where the emergences would happen. And if I could do that, then we could get ahead of them and maybe find the flight recorder, if it's still out there.
Everyone was silent.
That's very impressive, Elzar said. You should do that.
Kaven shrugged.
I'd like to. But I can't.
Why not?
I just said I need droids.
There are droids everywhere. Take those,
Senator Noar said, gesturing out the viewing panel at the assembly droids.
I need a lot.
How many?
If it's Navidroids, the very newest models, then 20 or 30,000, maybe? Like I said, they're good at this kind of thing. If it's regular droids or older navvies, a lot more. Like 100,000. And whichever kind we use, they'll all have to be linked together to make it work. Pretty big problem to solve.
More silence.
The Chancellor said we could use every resource, didn't she?
Eivor said.
Yes, but tens of thousands of Navidroids? That's...
Secretary Lorelia said, pursing his lips, thinking through the problem.
Many of those models are built directly into the ships they work with. Those could get here fairly quickly, but some would have to be... The Republic doesn't have that many, but perhaps we could acquire them from manufacturers.
You should get started, Elzar said. The sooner we begin, the sooner we might be able to get ahead of these emergencies. We can save lives, and ideally find the flight recorder.
Eivor spoke.
I've been thinking about something the Chancellor said, too. There's at least some chance this isn't a one-time problem, that there's something wrong with hyperspace on a larger scale. Do we have any idea how we might approach that? I'm not sure I even know where to begin.
If you want to know about hyperspace, I have the people you should talk to,
Senator Noar said.
They don't live out here anymore. They moved to the mid-rim when the family struck it rich. But I can make the introduction.
Who? Elzar said.
The San Tekka clan.
I know that name. The prospectors?
They prefer the term explorers. They're an odd bunch, but no one knows more about hyperspace than they do. If there's something wrong, they'll probably be able to help.
All right,
Eivor said.
Secretary Lorelia, will you work on the Navidroid issue with Kaventar? Elzar and I will meet with the San Tekkas to see if we can learn anything. Let's all stay in touch. As the Senator pointed out...
She looked again at what was once the Legacy Run...
We're running out of time.
Chapter 21.
no space.
Who are we?
Pan Ata roared, his already deep voice bellowing out of his huge chest, amplified and distorted by the mask he wore, which was itself a distorted version of his native Doatan face, with massive heavy brows and horns sprouting from his chin. His words crashed out across the sea of faces staring up at him and the others at his table. Most in the crowd wore masks of their own, of many designs, but one purpose. A few thousand people, from many worlds, across the galaxy, unified by a desire to take and kill and eat.
The Nihil!
Came the response, a thunderclap rolling back at him.
Let's do it right!
Lorna D cried, lifting a clenched fist on a thin, bare arm cabled with muscle. She was Twi'lek, of about 40 years, whip-thin with green skin, the color of swamp water. Emaciated Leku with bone-white stripes dangling from the back of her head. She wore armored leather made from the hide of a Kel dragon and a mask to match, with just the one arm bare and a single long-bladed knife sheathed on her thigh. Lorna stood next to Pan Ata on a raised platform at one end of the great hall of the Nihil, at a banquet table covered with rich food and potent liquor. Dozens more of these tables were placed throughout the hall, amid towers of flame pushing back the endless night. They were laden with indulgences for all to consume from as they chose. Food, drink, drugs, as much as they liked.
A storm!
The Nihil shouted back. The third and final of the Tempest Runners shouted his own question. This was Cassiv, an aged Weequay with skin like sun-dried meat, wearing only a fur cape, stained leather trousers, and his own mask, a thin plate of hammered metal with slits cut into it for eyes, nose, and mouth. A horrible parody of a face.
Who guides us?
He bellowed.
AI!
Came the answer, and at these words, the Nihil turned toward another platform, set lower than that of the Tempest Runners, where one person sat alone at an empty table. Marcion Rowe. He wore a mask too, but not like the others. His was unique, even in the Great Hall of the Nihil. Smoked transparasteel, with a single symbol slashed into it, a primitive, brutalist etching. Swirls and lines that evoked a stylized planet-killing superstorm as seen from space, with its central eye centered roughly over his face. His clothes were simple, black pants and jacket over a sleeveless white tunic, and tight leather gloves with padding at each knuckle. His limbs were long, and what parts of his skin were visible were slate gray. He wore no obvious weapons. Marcion tilted his head back, gazing out into the void that surrounded them all. Strange lights flickered in the far distance at the edge of vision through the full spectrum. The Nihil called this place No Space, and only they knew how to get there, via secret roads through tortuous hyperlanes unmapped in the galactic databases. Roads delivered by Marcion Rowe and his father before him. The Great Hall of the Nihil had no walls or ceiling, just invisible vacuum shields, creating a dome of breathable air above a broad durasteel platform hundreds of meters long. It looked and felt as if it were adrift in the great nothing. The symbolism was obvious and intentionally so. With the Nihil, all was light and life. Outside, cold, empty death.
What do I see?
Marcion Rose said, his voice quiet, a breath, not a scream. The crowd hushed to hear it.
What does your eye see for the Nihil?
Whatever we want!
Came the answering roar.
Immediate, every voice lifted, hungry and certain
and joyful. Marcion looked at Pan Eta and nodded. This was the Doatin show. The gigantic being adjusted the lapels of his leather suit, stylishly cut, its pale turquoise color chosen to set off his yellow skin.
That's right, Pan said. Whatever we want. Just like an Abdalish. We kill that convoy dead. We ripped those ships down to the bones and took everything they had. And now, everyone who fought alongside me there gets a share through the rule of three. With the Nihil, everyone eats.
Pan Eta pointed out off the platform into the strange wilderness of no space, where the emptiness was interrupted only by the fleet of ships that had carried the Nihil to this place. Marcion Rowe cast his eye across the vessels. No two exactly alike, and all reflecting the taste and cultures of their owners to some degree. They did all share a certain brutalist aesthetic, and the glowing green half-spheres that were the path engines. The navigational miracle provided to the organization by Marcion and his father. The Nihil's ships, large or small, looked like armored spiked fists coming to pound you into nothing and harvest your corpse. No curves where a straight line would do. Sharp edges, a lack of overall symmetry. The smaller, fighter-like starships, larger cloud ships and storm ships, all the way up to the three corvette-sized vessels of the Tempest Runners. Kossiv had the new elite. Pan Eta flew his Elegantia. And Lorna D? She called her ship the Lorna D. Much larger, imposing, looming behind the rest of the Nihil fleet with a silhouette like a marine predator, was Marcion Rowe's flying palace and fortress, its empty, echoing corridors the only home he had, the Gaze Electric.
That's why we all came here today,
Pan Eta said.
That's why we're celebrating. We fly together and we die together. And when we come back, we reap the rewards!
Pan gestured toward Lorna D and Kossiv.
I also gotta give my gratitude to my fellow bosses here. Abdalus was a job that came through my Tempest, but both Lorna D and Kossiv gave support with their crews. They all get their piece, too!
He reached to the table and lifted a massive goblet of spiced wine, showing it to the crowd, then turning to Marcion Rowe.
And here's to the Eye of the Nihil, who gave us the paths to make it all happen. Couldn't have done it without him.
Pan Eta tilted his head back, lifted his mask, and drained the goblet, wine splashing to the floor. The crowd roared its approval, and Marcion Rowe held up an acknowledging hand to the cheering Nihil.
But you know,
Pan said, setting down his goblet,
we could have done better. There were 6 freighters in that convoy, and we only took 5.
He affected a dissatisfied air, shaking his huge head.
We lost one in the attack. One of them blew up just as we were ripping it open. And whatever it had for us, now it's just hot dust.
He arced out his arm, sweeping it across the great hall.
Where's the Storm who was in charge of the crew assigned to that freighter?
A ripple across the assembly as heads turned, looking to see who would own up to the mistake. A few long moments passed, but eventually the pressure grew too great, and a man stood, part of Lorna D's Tempest by the minimalist clothing he wore. His species was hard to identify, but his mask had big, curling horns running down over the ears, little white slits for eyes, and the ever-present filter assembly over his nose and mouth, the better to survive the various chemical weapons of the Nihil often used in their raids. He had three jagged white stripes on his tunic, signifying his rank within the organization. Pan Aeta said, turning to Lorna D.
Looks like he's one of yours, Lorna. You mind if I...
Be my guest?
Lorna said, her voice without effect. She never revealed much of what was going on behind her eyes. Ice blue and ice cold.
His name is Zergyar.
Zergyar!
Pan Aeta cried, pointing at the man.
Bring the rest of your crew up here. The Cloud's End strikes.
Zergyar nodded at the group sitting at his table, and they stood as well. Seven men and women, all masked, all different, except that they shared the white slitted eyes of their leader. The Clouds had two of the jagged stripes somewhere on their clothing, and the strikes just one. They walked forward as a group, the other Nihil parting to let them through, to stand before Pan Aeta and the others.
What happened, Zergyar?
He said.
Why did we lose a sixth of what we went out there to get?
The Storm, to his credit, didn't try to dissemble. He just answered, plain and clean. No embellishing or hiding the truth. Marcion Rowe respected that.
One of my strikes, kid named Blit, miscalculated her harpoon shot. Hit one of the freighter's fuel tanks. That's all it took. Boom.
I thought it was something like that. Is she here? That strike?
No. Blit died in the explosion. Most of my crew did. I've only got these seven left. A couple Clouds, and five strikes.
Zergyar gestured at his people.
I see,
Pan said.
But someone has to pay for that mistake. Everyone lost when that happened. I lost.
He pointed down at Marcion Rowe, still seated at his own table, a meter or two below the Tempest Runners.
The I lost. It needs to be made right. For the Nihil.
Zergyar again showed no fear or anger, just responded, clear and honest. Marcion Rowe could see how the man had become a Storm, and that was not an easy thing to do. He rose in rank in the Nihil by succeeding, and by doing whatever it took to make sure other people didn't.
The Strike who screwed up paid with her life. Seems like that's something.
It's something. But that strike isn't here. You and your crew are all responsible. One of you could have given Blit better guidance. Could have helped her. You didn't. And there has to be a price. And someone has to pay it. I'll let you decide.
Zergyar hesitated, looking at his crew, one after the other, the masks making it impossible to know what they were thinking. A chant began, at the back of the hall, and rapidly moving forward, until every one of the Nihil was saying the same three words.
Pay the price! Pay the price! Pay the price!
Zagyar's crew tensed, looking at each other. Quick little furtive glances, not knowing who would be the first to move. Blasters were forbidden in the Great Hall, but they all had their blades, and hands were reaching toward hilts.
Pay the price!
Marcion Rowe turned his head, looking toward the edge of the platform, where a line of glowing blue-white lights marked the border between light and life and freezing void. He hated the little pageants Pan and Lorna and Kossuth put on, pitting clouds and strikes and storms against one another. The Nihil all worked under the same banner, and all used the paths Marcion gave them. But that was as far as it went. They were chaos. Everyone out for himself. Each Tempest ready to undercut the others. Any Nihil would slit another's throat at the slightest provocation or opportunity for profit. The paths could take the Nihil anywhere in the galaxy, but they refused to see it. The only one who could see the potential of the organization was, inevitably, the Eye. But the Eye was not in control. Each Tempest had its own boss, its runner, and Marcion Rowe had no real influence over what any of them did. He got his share of the payouts of any jobs that used his paths by the rule of three, but that was all. The Eye could see, but the Eye couldn't act. Sounds of struggle came to Marcion Rowe's ears, but he didn't turn to look. Someone was paying the price. He watched. All the Nihil watched as one of Zagyar's crew was dragged to the edge of the platform, screaming and pleading about how unfair it all was, how loyal they were. Marcion Rowe didn't know who had been chosen. Maybe Zagyar himself. It didn't matter. The lesson was clear. Every Nihil was expected to contribute. Either you made the organization richer, or you made it stronger. And one way to make something stronger was by removing what was weak. A body drifted away into the void of no space, still moving. Not for long. Pan Eta turned back to the Nihil. He spread his arms, taking them all in, while gesturing simultaneously at the feast tables and fountains filled with various intoxicants and death sticks and piles of up powder and down fire.
Now enjoy yourselves, my friends. You've earned this.
He stepped down from the tables as the Nihil resumed their celebrations. If any of them harbored misgivings about what had just occurred, they kept it hidden, behind masks and fistfuls of food and sniffs of powder. Music kicked up, loud, with a sound like sheets of metal being hammered in complex polyrhythms.
We need to talk,
Marcion Rowe said, looking at the three Tempest runners. Kossuth frowned.
It's a party, Marcion. Didn't you hear, Pan? Lots to celebrate. Why don't you just relax?
Marcion Rowe stared at the man for a full 3 seconds.
There's business to discuss, he said. It's important, and I want to talk about it while we're all in the same place and before you three get too drunk to think.
The Tempest Runners looked at one another. None of them happy. Lorna D shrugged.
Fine, Marcion. Fine. Let's go on back.
Marcion Rowe stepped down off the raised platform and walked toward the far end of the platform, the Tempest Runners falling in at his side. Nihil at all levels reached out to them, offering hands and greeting, desperate to make some connection with the organization's leadership. The group reached a small structure built at the far end of the Great Hall. It housed the airlock and docking mechanisms, as well as a small complex of rooms that offered privacy when required. Two droid sentries guarded its entrance and bowed their heads as Marcion and the Tempest Runners passed. The droids were well over 2 meters tall, matte black, and in lieu of rudimentary features, the 3 lightning bolts of the Nihil glowed on their faceplates in sharp blue-white. They carried no weapons and needed none. Their limbs and bodies were studded with sharp spikes. Their hands set in fists made of heavy alloys that could smash bone and tissue into pulp. Inside, once the entry portal had sealed, Marchion turned to face Kasav, Lorna D, and Pan Ata, each solely responsible for and with complete authority over a Tempest, one of the 3 great divisions of the Nihil.
Goodbye,
Kasav said. Kasav was always the first to talk, predictable as the sunrise. Either he hated silence, or he was pathologically focused on ensuring no one ever forgot he was there. Marchion Roe pulled off his mask, reaching up and running a hand through his long, dark hair, untangling it. The energy in the room changed. Even though the Tempest Runners had seen Marchion unmasked many times, his appearance tended to have a particular effect on those around him. Slate-gray skin, wholly black eyes, a certain angular leanness to his physique. For many of the galaxy species, the features of Marchion's people meant predator on some deep instinctive level.
Is it a good party, Kasav? Marchion said. All I saw was a big party. Numbers. Lots of new faces out there, from all 3 of your Tempests.
We always need new blood,
Pan Ata said. His voice was so low, some of his syllables dropped into subsonic ranges, giving him a wavery, resonant tone.
Strikes find other people to join. And when they get enough of a group under them, they move up to become a cloud. If they make the name, they get to be a storm. That's the way it works since always. You know this. Been like that since back when your father was the Eye.
Marchion Roe was more than a little certain that one of the 3 people standing before him had murdered his father. Asgar Roe, custodian of the paths, and Eye of the Nihil, until Marchion inherited the position and all that went with it on Asgar's death. But he didn't know which of the Tempest Runners had done the killing, and he was just the Eye. They were the bosses, and had 1,000 soldiers each. He only had 1 real ally. And she wouldn't be much good in a fight.
I know the way it works, Pan, Marchion said. But the paths aren't a limitless resource. Too many people means we can get spread too thin. We need to slow things down.
No one's gonna like that, Lorna D said. We don't slow down. We're the Nihil.
Marchion placed his index finger on his helmet.
The paths come from me, so now I'm saying we need to be a little careful about the next stage. That's all.
Is this about the Republic again?
Pan Ata said.
We've been over that. We know they're opening that station, that Starlight Beacon thing. But that doesn't mean they'll be coming after us. They think we're small time. They've never bothered us before, and they don't even have a military. How would they get us anyway? We've got your paths, right?
The Doatin adjusted his suit again. That polished turquoise leather. Pan was particular in his tastes. Everything was well chosen, from his clothes, to the food he ate, to the music he listened to. The Nihil and his Tempest tended to be the same way.
From the beginning, Pan had chosen his first strikes, and they had chosen theirs, and like called to like. Each of the Tempests reflected its runner. Pan's people were precise, planners. Kossov's group was chaotic and impulsive. All of his strikes and clouds and storms chasing the next score, the next insane story they could brag about while so high on smash they could barely talk. Lorna D's group was subtle, introverted, keeping their intentions close until the result was achieved. Also, in general, her people were the cruelest among all the Nihil.
It's not just the Starlight Beacon. It's that Legacy Run thing in Hetzal, Marchion said. These emergences are causing disasters all over the Rim. My people in the Republic tell me they're digging in hard. They've set up an investigation, even pulled in the Jedi.
Jedi,
Kossov said, baring his sharp little teeth.
I've always wanted to kill one. That'd be a story to tell.
Marchion knew Kossov had never faced a Jedi. Neither had Marchion Ro. But his family had a history with them. And he had grown up hearing stories. Even a few could destabilize or destroy the grandest aspiration. They could tap into something. It wasn't just the Force. It was their order itself. It gave them a confidence, a structure, a willingness to make choices to serve the larger purpose of spreading light in the galaxy. It made them bold. It made them strong. He was not afraid of the Jedi, but only a fool wouldn't consider them a serious threat.
You're welcome to try to kill as many Jedi as you want, Kossov, Marchion said. Just give us the name of the storm you think should take your place as Tempest Runner after you're dead.
He waited before speaking again, letting his gaze shift to each of them in turn, letting his cold, dark eyes do most of the work. The silence turned to tension. And Marchion just kept watching, daring any of them to challenge him again. They didn't. They wouldn't. Not openly, anyway. He knew any one of these three would cut off his head in an instant if they knew how to access the paths directly. But he kept that secret close.
Here's what I'm worried about, Marchion said. All three of you run your operations pretty independently, and you have crews doing raids all over the Outer Rim. Chancellor So put a hyperspace blockade in place, and it gets bigger with every emergence. The Nihil are just about the only ships that can travel these days, because we have the paths. What if the Republic comes across a Nihil crew and figures out we can do what we do? Or the Jedi? We don't want the Order on us. Or the Republic Defense Coalition.
He shook his head.
I know the Republic doesn't have a standing military. Doesn't matter. We aren't big enough to take them on, even if it's just an RDC task force. They'd wipe us out. I say we need to lie low. No new operations for the time being. No more paths. If your people give you grief, tell them the Eye sees something special in the future. Something big. A new initiative.
Does the Eye, in fact, see that?
Lorna D asked.
A new initiative, I mean?
I'm always thinking of the next thing, Lorna, he said. You know that.
Kossov and Pan Ata exchanged a glance.
Just doesn't sound like us,
Kossov said.
I call the vote, Marchion said.
Then I vote this is a big pile of bantha droppings,
Kossev said.
The Nihil don't stop. We need to keep riding that storm.
You know, Panetta
said,
I think I agree with Marchion. I say we take a little break. Just for a while. Maybe we should take a little time to plan, strategize, figure out how we operate if the Republic's gonna be poking around in our territory.
Said Kossev.
Of course! You and your people just got fat off that job in Abdolis, so you don't need to eat for a while. What about the rest of us?
Maybe you should have given me more of your people to help, Kossev,
Pan said.
One little cloud worth of crew was all you could spare? Please. Anyway, I don't mind a little break. Maybe I'll take a vacation. Get tickets to the opera on Cato Nymordia.
Kossev made a disgusted noise deep in his throat. The rest of the vote was moot. In any decision related to the paths, ties went to the eye. A long-standing rule. With Pan's vote, it was at least a 2-against-2 decision for putting a hold on new Nihil activity. At least until the heat from the Legacy Run died down. Lorna D hadn't spoken, but her decision was irrelevant, and it wasn't surprising she had waited to make her views known. She seemed to prefer that people knew as little as possible about what she was thinking. Whether that was pathological or tactical, Marchion didn't know. Probably some of both.
I guess that's that,
Lorna D said.
But I still want to pitch you on a job.
Oh? Marchion said, his voice thin. Pan Eta and Kossev didn't seem particularly thrilled either. Tempest runners could authorize raids within their own crews without asking any of the others, but anything that would require paths needed a full-on vote. Usually that meant Marchion was the deciding factor, because most of the time the two Tempest runners who didn't have a stake in a given job voted against it. Not a bad system, really. Marchion was the custodian of the paths, and so he should have the loudest voice in deciding how they were used.
I have a new group in my Tempests,
Lorna continued.
7 strikes under a cloud. Came to me with a really interesting plan, actually. They found this settler family on the mining world. Very connected. My guys want to kidnap them, hold them for ransom from their rich relatives. It's smart.
No, Lorna. I told you. We all just agreed. No raids until the heat dies down from Hetzal. She stepped toward him, her thin face focused, her eyes intense.
I'm telling you, Marchion, it'll be easy. The planet is Elfrona, which doesn't have much of a security force. And apparently, the family decided to go all rustic. Live way out on their own in the middle of nowhere. Easy pickings. We'll be in and out.
Marchion went still, which Lorna took as an invitation to keep talking.
The cloud asked for some paths. You know, just in case. I know we're under pressure, but this is a new group. Lots of potential. I want to bring them into the fold. Give them a chance to prove their worth. I'm telling you, too, this operation will have a huge payoff.
Elfruna. Marchion said. There's a Jedi outpost on that planet.
Is there?
Asked Lorna D, in a way that made it clear she had already known. Marchion went silent. The Nihil were not just another group of raiders, like the thousands that operated in the Rim. They were special, powerful. And the reason for that was the paths. In all the ways that counted, they made the Nihil what they were. They allowed crews to use hyperspace in ways denied to every other ship in the galaxy. Microjumps, leaps to locations inside gravity wells, entering hyperspace from almost anywhere, as opposed to having to run elaborate calculations or travel to a non-occluded access zone. They allowed the Nihil's ships to appear and disappear at will, like spirits. They could be anywhere, at any time, and no defenses could stop them. The paths made the Nihil what they were, but they came from a single, unique, not inexhaustible source. And Marchion had placed significant demands upon that source recently, both to fuel the Nihil's growth and to support plans of his own. The Legacy Run disaster was not the only reason he wanted things to cool off for a little while. Lorna D's idea, though, it had possibilities. There was no need to hold a formal vote. Lorna D was obviously for it, and the Eye's two votes would ensure it went ahead if Marchion Roe agreed.
Fine, he said. Send me the plan, what you think you'll need, and I'll get you some paths. But do not do anything to get the attention of those Jedi. Get in, grab the family, get out.
Thank you, Lorna D said, and left.
As ever, the woman never said a word more than she needed to. Kossev and Pan Eta glanced at each other, then back at Marchion Roe.
Pan shrugged. He left, following Lorna D back to the celebration outside.
Kossev did not. Marchion lifted his mask and replaced it on his head.
Dunno how that was fair, Ro, the Weakway said. You giving Lorna D a job, giving her paths, but saying Pan and me gotta stop? I got people to feed too. I got like 1,000 people in my Tempest, and ain't one of them gonna be happy about this. How about I send you some ideas? Maybe you choose one, and I get something going. You'd get a share too. A full third to the Eye, just like always. Don't you want that payday?
They returned to the Great Hall, walking past the spiked guard droids, who once again inclined their heads as the Eye and the Tempest Runner passed. Marchion walked to the edge of the platform, Kossev close on his heels, right up against the blue lights that marked the border of the vacuum shields.
Your father never would have done something like this, Kossev said. Shutting down the paths? Forget it. Not Ascon Roe. He wasn't any kind of coward. No way.
Marchion Roe went very still.
My father's dead, Kossev, he said. I'm the Eye now. You can do whatever you want with your Tempest, but the paths come from me. You don't like it? You want to make a play for me? Try to take what I've got? Go for it. Just be aware.
He gestured out of the void.
There's a price.
Chapter 22, The Outer Rim. Elfrona Outpost.
What are you waiting for?
Loden said. Bell crept closer to the edge of the cliff and peered over. The ground didn't look any closer than it had the last four times he checked. He looked back at his master, who had his arms folded. He was smiling, but it was one of those smiles that felt much more like a deep, disapproving frown.
Get on with it,
that smile said.
Unless you'd prefer to be a Padawan for the rest of your life.
The Jedi Order had established outposts across the less settled sectors of the Republic, both as an opportunity to explore new regions and to offer assistance to any who might need it in those wilder zones. Not as large as full temples, they were staffed by crews of 3 to 7 Jedi, often with a wide range of experience. Getting outposted was a common part of the Padawan training regime, and this was what Bell was doing on Alfrona. He and Loden had been there for a while, though they did get the occasional off-world assignment, like the Starlight Beacon tour that had ended up with them in the middle of the Legacy Run disaster. They were originally due to be rotated back to Coruscant after that via the Third Horizon, but Chancellor So's hyperspace blockade had gotten them sent back to the outpost for the duration. The Council thought Jedi might be needed in the Outer Rim more than usual during the crisis. So far, though, the blockade didn't feel much different from the usual sort of outpost life. For Jedi Padawan Bell Zedifar, that meant constant orders from his master to do utterly impossible things under the guise of training. The wind kicked up, pushing Bell back from the cliff's edge. He inhaled the unique scent of Alfrona, hot metal and dust. The Order often built its outposts to fit in with the natural surroundings and culture of the planet where they were based. The outpost on Kashyyyk was a huge treehouse. On Mon Cala, it was a gigantic raft grown from coralite, kelp dangling from its underside, providing a reef-like habitat for local sea creatures as it drifted with the currents. Alfrona was a dry world of slate and clay, topographically diverse. Almost its entire surface was covered by long mountain ranges, composed primarily of iron and other ferrous minerals, which curled along its surfaces in arcs that followed the pattern of the planet's magnetic fields. From orbit, it looked beautiful, like a calligrapher had inscribed the entire world with some unimaginably enormous pen. From the ground, it looked exactly like you would think a huge ball of dusty metal might, a world whose bones were close to the skin. In this hard place, the Jedi had built their outpost out of a mountainside, or rather, into it. A face of the Iron Mountain had been sheared away, carved with laser chisels into a columned, temple-like entrance. The entrance was flanked by 2 massive statues of Jedi Knights, their lightsabers out and held in the ready position. The Jedi wore hooded robes of a style that felt like a nod to an earlier era.